Hello and welcome to Before Our Friends Die. You're joined by me, Kavan, and this is the Aki and Saltfish Digital Network. You can see I'm joined by educational and EDI consultant Asara Otobo, and she's here to talk all about her career, her influences, and if you didn't know, right now is Black History Month, so we're going to touch on sisterhood and who her inspirations are, because for me, Asara is one of my inspirations in my career and what I'm trying to achieve. So it's a pleasure to be joined by you today, Asara. Let's get stuck straight in. Wow. Hello. So thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. How are you
Thank
doing?
Thank you for having me.
Listen, it's no problem at all. This has been a long episode in the making. As soon as, I think I met Asara maybe 18 months ago, maybe a little over a year ago. And yeah. We were working on a similar project at work. Well, we work in separate places, but Asara was consulting on a project I was working on at work. And the concept of a consultant was something that has always interested me. I was having a chat with someone yesterday and I described myself as someone who is naturally curious about experts in their field. And that is exactly what I was interested in when I heard from Asara. She was giving some great insights to the project that we were working on. And if I'm being honest as well, Asara is young. So I thought, okay, this is an interesting angle on this consultancy thing. I thought consultancy was like an old person's job. You know, you've gone through a career, you've retired, now you just want to be a consultant on the side. But Asara really, for me, flipped the script. And that's what we're here to talk about, flipping the script on consultancy and her experiences in the field. So to get stuck into that, what was your first sort of exposure to this field, and why are you in consultancy at this point?
Really good question. If I cast my mind back to when I was a student officer at Hull, so I was president of my students' union, and I think the first time I came across a consultant was when someone came in to do a governance review of our university board. And I had a chat with him because he told me that he had been an officer for NUS many, many years ago. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. So someone who was in a similar-ish position to me is now a consultant. But honestly, even after that conversation, I didn't really think about it as a career for me until towards the end of my terms as president. Someone from the university leadership team, I had a one-to-one chat with them, and she was asking me, oh, what are you interested in? And I listed a whole range of things. I'm someone that's just like interested in loads of stuff, and it's hard to like pick one thing to focus on. So I was like, oh yes, I did biomedical science when I joined here, so I'm interested in that. And I did some student brand ambassador work for Spotify, so I'm interested in like the PR marketing stuff. And then she was the one that actually planted the seed in my head. She said, you know, the work that you've done here at Hull, people would pay you good money to do it elsewhere as a consultant. And I was like, interesting. Because I really enjoyed the projects that I did as a student officer. So the thought of like someone actually paying me, someone like young like me, someone that looks like me, like money to do that sort of work, I found it like really intriguing. So after I'd finished my time as president, I reached out to someone in LinkedIn. LinkedIn at the time had a function where you can like pair up with a mentor in a particular field that you were interested in.
Wow, that's I didn't even hear about that on LinkedIn. So that's
amazing. Yeah, I don't think it's a thing anymore. So I think it was only about for like a few months. They may have tried it out and it didn't work well for some people, but I just typed in, I'm interested in consulting in higher education. And there were a few people that came up, and then there was this one man that came up and he had a consultancy. And so that's really where it all began. I had chats with him on LinkedIn just to see like how this all works. And that's how it started off.
Wow. So, I mean, a couple of things I want to pick up on there. Spotify, that opportunity sounds amazing. Talk to me about that.
Honestly, the coolest job I've ever done. So it was a student brand manager role. And what that entailed was, Spotify hired a PR agency who specialized in doing work with students in higher ed and to help promote their brand.
Yeah.
And so it was basically making Spotify cool on campus. I didn't have to sell anything. It was just like raising the brand awareness. So if there was a really cool party happening in Hull, then I had like a party set that I could give to people, which had like a speaker. speaker glow sticks,
go on,
beer pong balls, whatever you want, fairy lights. So that was quite cool. And then another part of the job was like creating playlists. So they'll give us like a theme. And so, for example, a theme would be like freshers. So what sort of music would people listen to if they're getting pumped to go to university? So yeah, creating playlists like that.
So you're paid to create a playlist?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So honestly, it was so good.
That's the drip. Tell you what, if Spotify, if you're listening, we've got a show on the network called Cool, Fine, Dumb, Wicked that is all about music. We'd love to be Spotify brand ambassadors. Get in touch, akiandsaltfish@gmail.com. Oh, sorry, that sounds like the dream job. Forget consultancy. We're flipping the script on the episode.
It's genuinely like, wow. It was a dream.
Wow. So you're someone that gets in the spaces I want to be in. That's amazing. That's amazing. So, just out of curiosity, do you have any of those playlists around? Could we pop one in the description?
I think I still have a link to some of the playlists.
Throw us it. Let's get it in the description. Check the show notes out below. If Osaro sends me the link, I'll put it in the description. I want to hear more about that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'll send that afterwards.
Wicked. Thank you. One of the other things you mentioned as well was being a president of an SU. Yeah. Like, if I think back to my time at university, I remember the president. Her name was Rachel. I can't remember her last name. So, I'm not incriminating anyone. But it just felt so far removed from my experience. I just felt like, nah, that's not what people like me do. But you're someone like me and you did it. So what was your experience in that space? And why was that of interest to you? Like, what sparked your interest in that? Because I do see the parallels between that presidency, that sort of offering that student representation, that student voice, and then being a consultant later on down the line. So what was it that sort of sparked that interest for you?
Yeah, I honestly felt similar to you. It seemed like a role that was very far removed from me. All of the student officers in my university when I was first year, they were all white.
Yeah.
The president was a white man who I actually ended up being friends with, and he's still one of my very good friends.
Go on.
And what brought me to the point where I thought, oh, actually I could be a president, he was actually the one that told me, you know, you would actually be a great president. And so it's another thing of someone telling me, you know, you should think about going for this role, the same way that someone told me about consultancy. And I think it's so important to have positive people around you saying that, you know, I see something in you and I think you can do a thing. So, he was the first person that planted the seed in my head. And then through that, I got involved with like campaigning in SU elections for other people. Including one of my friends who he was our first black international president, and he's still one of my very good friends as well. And the reason why I wanted to get into that space is because I didn't see someone looking like me. So by the time I was president of my student union, they had never had a black woman in that role ever. They never had a black president who was there for two terms, which is like the maximum amount you can go for. And it was 9 years since they ever had a woman in that president role. So I wanted to be the one to
pioneer.
Do it.
Love that. Trailblazer.
And honestly, I was also very frustrated about EDI at the university. I didn't really hear anyone talking about diversity and inclusion in terms of the projects they were doing. There was no Black History Month led celebrations by the Students' Union as well. And that was definitely one of the things that I wanted to change when I came in post. So yeah, it was someone encouraging me to go for the role, but also frustrations of not seeing people that looked like me in the space and talking about issues that I cared about.
If I could ask you a really obtuse question, but for the benefit of the listeners, for the benefit of a complete story, why did EDI matter to you?
Now that's it's an important question because people have their own reasons why it is important to them. I think for me, if I think back to my own educational journey, I was born in Hackney, very diverse place. I never felt like someone who didn't belong in the space in my primary school. And then I moved primary schools and still it was quite a diverse place, not Manchester, Walthamstow. Don't know why I said Manchester, Walthamstow. And then it wasn't until I went to secondary school and I went to school in Essex, and I was one of three black girls in my form class of 30, and we all looked very different, had different names, and people still confused us. And
wild.
From year seven to sixth form, I was in a very, very white space. It was very much, you know, TOWIE, the only way is Essex.
Yeah. Shut up.
Yes, that was it. And that was the idea of like beauty, like fake tan, white skin, bleached hair, all of that. And I didn't feel like I like was appreciated in that space. And so when I went to university, there was a lot of there was some diversity there, which was great, but I also felt quite it was quite a big adjustment for me, because I was from London, very diverse place, and I went all the way to Hull, which is not super diverse like London. And I did feel a bit homesick because of that lack of diversity there. So I wanted people to not feel like they were alone. I wanted them to feel like they belonged in that space. And so I think that was probably like the biggest reason why EDI was important for me. And why I really wanted to work on that, because I had to seek out communities when I was at university. So I joined Afro-Caribbean Society. I never really thought about joining a thing like that before, but I was drawn to that because I wanted people that looked like me. And I think belonging is so important. People go to university for a degree, but like, if you don't feel like you belong in that space, you're not going to achieve all of the things you can achieve. So yeah, that's why it's important, I think.
So mindful of asking you this question because you might invoice me for a consultancy, but what are the pillars of belonging?
Wow.
If you to list off, I don't know, four.
Okay. Pillars of belonging. I guess like feeling a sense of safety in the space, so whether that's mentally or physically. Community, so knowing that you have a group of people who either look like you or have like similar interests to you. I guess identity is really important as well, and I think all of these pillars, they all link with each other, but identity is a big one. Like, do you identify with that space? Does that space identify with you? For example, there are people who can have like a great attachment to a particular group. Let's say, so I'm an Arsenal fan. And so...
you know what? We're actually not that football focused on the Akin Selfish Digital Network. So you can be an Arsenal fan and it can be a safe space for you. Don't worry.
Okay. Thank you very much. So I'm an Arsenal fan and I love the club, and it's something that I identify with. But imagine if the club had like senior people at the top who had said openly racist stuff, and that's them showing that, oh, they don't appreciate people that look like me. That's not the case, but that's just an example of that identity pillar. So I've given you three things there.
There you go. And for the fourth one, I've got to pay. I understand that. That's fine.
So,
you know, one of the things you mentioned there was around when you were the president, that, you know, representation was a key thing for you. What sort of things do you think that helped with that representation? I.e., what sort of activities did you do? Because what I'm really trying to get at here is that there is action you can do in your local space, wherever that may be, if you're listening, that can help create a space for you, even if you originally feel like it's not for you. And I'm trying to sort of tease that out there.
Yeah. Okay. So when I was president, there was some things that I worked on relating to like careers. So one thing that I will say is that think about all of the different services that a university or a student union may offer, and think about how that could be inclusive. So there are so many different ways that you can try and lobby for change, whether it's like through campaigning, talking directly to people with power, being open about what your thoughts are on social media and stuff like that. So one of the things that I thought was really important people go to, as I said, university for a degree, but also they want to have a job. Mm. Well, a lot of them want to have a job afterwards. And so some people may feel safe at university, but maybe a bit, feel a bit daunted about what the workspace will be like. And so I worked quite closely with the careers team, and we did, for example, an event around diversity and inclusion in the workspace, and we invited employers that had said that they were passionate about EDI. And so that gave an opportunity for people from like marginalized and minoritized backgrounds to like talk to these employers and see what sorts of things should be offered in workspaces so that they feel safe. So I think that's one thing that I quite liked that I worked on. I mentioned Black History Month. I think it's so important to have celebrate the different identities that we have that make up a university. So and it should be all year round. Like, for example, Black History Month, it shouldn't just be like only talk about Black people.
Tell them again.
Yeah. Don't talk about Black people only in Black History Month. Like, it's an all year round thing. And actually, I saw someone share something that they're working on at a different university, and their campaign was Black History 365. So a whole year thing. I thought that was cool.
That was SOAS, I think. I don't know how you actually say that. Yeah. S-O-A-S. I don't know if it is SOAS, but I think Rukia is the lady I saw on LinkedIn doing that. Yeah, she's amazing. Rukia Osman, I think her name is. Yeah. I bumped into her a few times at a few conferences. So shout out, Rukia, if you're listening. Black History Month 365, love it. One of the things I wanted to seize out, because actually you mentioned moving from Hackney to Essex eventually, and we had a guest on a year ago, Ellie, and he has an online persona or online account called Mindful Black Dad. It's great. I reckon anyone check it out on Twitter and Instagram, all those great things. It does what it says on the tin. How to be a mindful Black Dad, really interesting stuff. He talks about his racial consciousness being present early in him, but him noticing it a little bit more when he moved from literally Hackney, actually, to a town he didn't mention, but he mentioned it was significantly more white than Hackney. And one of the things he noted was not only did that make him reflect deeper on his own identity and in essence make him more passionate about his blackness, because, well, if I'm not, no one around me is going to be anymore because I'm not in Hackney anymore. But secondly, he noted that the black people he did encounter in this secondary space, they didn't do like things like the nod, the wave, the smile, the welcoming nature, that's that safety net of being in a space where diversity is accepted and is the norm, to now moving to a space where diversity is the othered characteristic, and therefore people didn't necessarily feel comfortable to sort of build those bonds or identify their blackness between each other. It was a very interesting observation. So just one thing I want to touch on before we get into your sort of day-to-day activities is that experience in Essex, and in terms of your identity, did it repress your identity, and did you feel that need to want to fit in, or did it galvanize your identity and make you want to represent for others? Because what I'm seeing throughout what you discussed there is some serious leadership qualities in terms of not only fighting on your own behalf, but identifying how you can support others as well.
Yeah, no, that's a really brilliant question. And when I was in Essex, so my secondary school was in Essex, I lived in East London, but it was borderline London, Essex. So whenever people tell me that I live in Essex, I'm like, no, yeah, I'm in East London. I'm still East London, but barely. But honestly, it was so difficult talking about blackness in a space like that because it was looked down upon. So, for example, like just something as simple as our hair, like you wouldn't see people with their natural afro hair out. If you did, then it would be straightened. Like that's what I would do if I did have my hair out. And then also in a space like that, there was a particular way that Black people were expected to behave. So let's say, for example, in terms of the music you listen to, I have quite a broad music taste. And like people thought it was weird that I liked rock music. Like one of my favorite bands is a rock band. And I found it quite hard in that space because I had people, like white people being white, and like it's their space. But then also the example you gave about like black people not like doing the nod and stuff like that, because I was like slightly different, there were other black people that were a bit like, oh, she's a bit weird. So it was hard to like be open at all, have that leadership that I'm talking about in terms of fighting for like black rights and stuff like that. And it wasn't until I was in university and I felt like it's a space where you can like be more yourself.
Yeah.
And you cling more onto your identity, as you said, because you're in a very different space. And my university space was still quite white, but I was older, more confident. And that did make me cling on more to like my black identity. So people who see the sort of work I do now in terms of EDI, anti-racism work, if they knew me from like secondary school, they'd probably be a bit surprised, like, oh wow, I didn't know that she was like so passionate about these issues. But yeah, I feel like I was kind of pushed into it because I was being pushed into like more and more white spaces. And I just needed to like push back against that and yeah, just have a more inclusive space.
That's interesting. And I wasn't going to ask this question next, but do you feel like then you had agency in that choice, or do you feel like it's something you had to do?
I keep saying good questions, so I'm going to stop saying that. But yes and no. So I think you definitely could have just kept quiet and not put yourself in like the front lines in talking about EDI work, anti-racism work. I have a lot of friends that, you know, they may be passionate about those issues, but they just didn't really feel like they had the time or energy or passion to do about it. But I think maybe it's just my personality. I hate seeing like injustice, and I always think, you know, if I'm unhappy about something, I want to be the one to like make the change. I don't want to just like be quiet and moan about it. If no one else is doing it, then I'll do it. So I think, yeah, that's why. And so that's why I think it's a bit of like a 50-50 thing.
I appreciate that. Thank you. So one of the things I want to talk about is you mentioned your first introduction into your EDI and educational consultancy field is around, or was around, seeing a governance review take place in and around your sort of SU space. What do you do on an average day as Osaro?
So this is one of the things that I love about my work. Every day feels very different. So as a consultant, we work with a number of different clients on different projects. So one day I could have some interviews in to interview a particular university that's conducting a governance review with us. So I'm interviewing the members of their board and finding out what they think the strengths and weaknesses are of that organization. In the same day, I could be observing a meeting. So I could be observing a committee meeting, an EDI committee meeting, for example. And then another thing that I might do is deliver training. So I deliver anti-racism training in for student unions, universities. A lot of it has been with student unions, though. And yeah, it's just, it could be very random. And so a lot of my work is working from home, but a client may want us to go in person to do a thing. So one of my days could be just taken up by travel. So I wake up early, travel, go to the location, do what I need to do in terms of interviews or an observation, and then I come back home. Or what I love is if I can come the night before.
There you go.
Stay in a nice hotel.
Expenses.
reasonable expenses.
There you go. Reasonable. Yeah, there you go. That key word there.
Yeah. So yeah, that's, I enjoy doing that and being able to like see a city that I may have never been to before, or have only been to maybe once before, so I quite like that I can travel sometimes.
Let's just list off some of the places you've been.
Oh, Manchester, Newcastle. I went to Winchester for the first time this year.
Where's
that?
That
was quite cute. I'm really bad
Exactly. It's somewhere like Sussex or something like that. I don't know. Somewhere like that in the world. Yeah.
Somewhere like that. It's not that far. I think it was like an hour and a bit by train.
Yeah.
And it's quite a small, like, quaint city. It's very, very nice. Went to Cardiff for the first time 2 years ago. That was really cool. And I've been back since twice. Yeah.
Go on. That's
Wait, three times. So that's cool. I've been to the north of England quite a lot. So Newcastle, I don't know if I already mentioned that. I've been to Scotland. So I was in Edinburgh this summer.
Beautiful
for
city,
a conference. Oh, I love Edinburgh. And I was delivering two sessions at the conference. It's the Case Europe conference, which is related to marketing, fundraising, alumni development, that sort of part of the university, and we were talking about anti-racism in that space. So yeah, Edinburgh was cool.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And just to give the listeners a reminder and yourself, I suppose, a bit of context on why this show is what it is. It's called Before Our Friends Die, and the motto behind it is, before our friends die, we want them to know about insert topic here. And in terms of consultancy, the things you've mentioned, I'm gonna ask again quite an obtuse question, and I need you to defend the profession now for me. Why not go internally for a governance review? Why not go internally for those board interviews? Why not go internally for those training opportunities? You know, like, explain why consultancy is necessary in these spaces, please.
Yeah, I think one of the major things about consultancy is that a consultant can bring best practice from elsewhere. I think when you're stuck in an institution, you may have like really good ideas that work, but sometimes you may struggle to like look outside the bigger outside the box and look at the bigger picture. So I think that's something that a consultant can bring. Another thing is that we don't have any ties to the institution, so there's not going to be any bias there, and I think that can also build trust with people that take part in a review or a training session. And I think trust is so important, because a lot of people that we do talk to, stakeholders, they feel like they can be very open with us in our one-to-one chats, because everything's anonymized, and then we input that into our report, put it back to the client so that they can see truthfully how people feel. And a lot of those people would have been too scared or worried to say their true thoughts and opinions directly to people who are people in positions of power. And the people fear for their jobs. They fear, oh, if I am very bold, then I might have a mark over my head and I may lose my job in the future. So I think that's another reason why bringing in someone independent is so important.
And I suppose the immediate connection I can see is, you said earlier that you felt an internal drive to do something because action wasn't being done. So imagine if you were in an organization where action isn't being done. Do you think it's going to be easy? And this is not a question to you, this is a rhetorical question for the listeners, I guess. Do you think it's going to be easy to speak up and be that leader for change when the status quo is as it is and is maintained by the structures that exist? Or would it be easier to bring in someone external with fresh eyes and perhaps less ties to be able to say it how it is? So yeah, I think I can definitely see you've made a strong argument there for consultancy. And another thing that could contribute to that strong argument is something I want to bring up. And I haven't briefed you on this, so I apologize in advance, but hopefully we can have a good discussion about it. Living Black at university.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about some of the successes you've had. And for me, I think our initial contact was off the back of, or in the same space or as Living Black at University and an initiative that we worked on at the University of Northampton. So Living Black at University, explain that to the listeners. What does that mean? Because we've sort of alluded to your experience living Black at university, but what I'm talking about is a report that you really pioneered. So let's get into that.
Yeah. I'm gonna drop a fun fact. So
Go
I came up with the name Little Zakat University.
on. There you go. That's that PR. That's that marketing. If you didn't do that Spotify thing, you would not have come up with that name, because that's
Exactly.
that grounding. There you go, listeners. Everything has its contribution to your final sum. Love that.
The research looks at the experiences of Black students in accommodation, and it came about because Unite Students, who are probably the biggest accommodation provider in the
Yeah.
country, following on from the resurgence of Black Lives Matter in 2020, they wanted to do something. And one of the issues that they saw was that there wasn't many, there wasn't any research actually specifically on Black students in accommodation. They have, there's been research on ethnic minorities, so they've grouped them all together in BAME, and then they have like statistics for white, but there hasn't been like granular data that has like drilled down to those specific experiences that Black students face. So they wanted to find a Black-led research team. And so someone recommended someone, I think it was Heppy actually, Nick Hillman from Heppy recommended us because he had seen my report that I did in 2020 on how universities had responded to Black Lives Matter. So I believe this must have been like 2021 that Unite Students reached out to us for this research project. And so I was the project manager and researcher for this. And then Teleola Cartwright, who's also done some work for Northampton, she was the lead researcher. And then also we had a student from Northampton, Lenny Emanuel, who was a law student, and he also helped with the research as well. So yeah, three Black people on the research team, which was great. And so yeah, we had focus groups with Black students, and they were really open to us in those spaces. And it was sad because a lot of the things that they were saying resonated with all of us. So me, Teleola, Lenny were all different, like, ages, but we could still recognize some of the things that the Black students of today were still saying. Like, it's so sad that it's still happening, experiencing racism in your accommodation, feeling like you're being picked on by members of staff and stuff like that. So yeah, those focus groups are really powerful. And we were conscious that we didn't want to water down the report for the sector, because I know sometimes people may get scared of about being like really brutally honest about what the truth is when it comes to issues related to EDI and specifically anti-racism. People don't want to hear that they have racist policies and stuff like that. But we were like really adamant about like some of the phrasing that we had in the research report. And thankfully it landed well. People really took on board the report. And also a shout out to Unite actually, because a lot of the time with research, sometimes you have the research report and then nothing gets done afterwards, but they actually invested money in creating a commission. So the commission had members of some people from university accommodation teams, some people from like higher education organizations like the OIA, and I'm trying to think of another one off the top of my head, Unipol. So like big players, someone from Advanced HE as well. So we can all go together and work through each of the recommendations. So there's 10 recommendations of the report, and each meeting we would come together, talk about exactly how can we help with implementing this recommendation, how can we help everyone else implement this recommendation. And as we speak, they are writing up a report for what has gone on this past 12 to 18 months with the commission. And so that's going to be another resource from the Living Black Research Project that people will be able to have, and hopefully it can help them make more change in their institution.
What I'll do as well is I'll link that below in the description as well, so you can check out the report. I just wanted to touch on something you mentioned. You know, people and institutions more generally don't want to accept that they have racist policies, and generally speaking, are racist institutions. Do you think the tide is shifting, or do you think there's still that level of resistance there?
There is still a level of resistance. I do feel things are a lot better than they were like pre-2020. There are people that are openly having conversations about anti-Black racism. There are people that are hiring people like me to come into their institution, and they're not scared to hear about what they're doing wrong, and they want to hear about things that they are doing better. I've seen different universities put money behind initiatives to help Black students and Black staff. So I do see that there is a positive difference happening, but it is slow. And unfortunately, it's not widespread across the sector. And there is the momentum is dwindling, in my own opinion. You don't see the whole sector talking about this issue as much as I feel they should do. For example, I went to a conference a few months ago, earlier this year, and there was a panel related to EDI, and they didn't talk about anti-Black racism once or anti-racism at all. Right. And then it really like surprised me. And if you looked at the panel, there was not one Black person there. So like, maybe that's why. And then also another like topical EDI issue at the moment is trans rights. And that wasn't even discussed either at that space. And you'd think that in a conference, when they have a title about like talking about prominent EDI issues, you would talk about those two topics, because that's what people are like kind of trying to tackle at the moment. But they shied away because I think they feel those conversations are difficult. And yeah, it is a shame.
If I could, I suppose, import some of my personal view, I think the field, EDI, not lacks it, but can sometimes be found wanting in terms of a critical lens. So sometimes we're a very welcoming community who accept people who say, I'm passionate about EDI. And they leave it there. There's no depth. Yeah. So then we see panels where they talk about EDI, but they're not talking about anti-Black racism or anti-racism. Mm-hmm. They're not discussing trans rights, because those things are too hot to touch. So they don't discuss them, because those are difficult conversations to have. The easier conversations are talking about I'm not critiquing discussions on inclusion. Inclusion is important. What does that mean? What does that mean for you? What does that mean for us? What does that mean for the different groups? Inclusion is different in many for different people. Even if I'm gonna lean on a paradox, inclusion for some people may result in exclusion for others because of the nature of, to be inclusive, we may have to say, you know what, actually that viewpoint isn't welcome.
Yeah.
And thus there is an inherent exclusion. But that discourse needs to be had. Sorry for the listeners, that may be uncomfortable. But that discourse needs to be had. But those conversations are challenging, right? So what I found is that the field tends to just, okay, we'll ignore that critical lens on it, and we'll just praise people for talking about EDI. So that's where I feel like people like yourself, who not only did you do a reflection on what universities are doing at 2020 for BLM or in relation to BLM, you've also recently done a follow-up on sort of 3 years later. What's the discourse like? What's going on? And I think that holding the sector to account consistently is what's needed. So I wanted to offer you that praise there publicly. So, you know, when we talk about this, developing the sector, and I mean the HE sector, the higher education sector, and then discussing EDI, often we talk to leaders and leaders leading from the top and making that change and making that cultural shift, and that is incredibly valuable. But what I'm going to say is there is a lot of resource out there for those leaders, and I'm probably just going to say go and speak to Asaro. I'll put her details below, and she can advise you if you're a leader on that. and maybe we will get to one or two bits of advice. But while you're here, Osaro, if I may, I want to ask you if you've got any advice for students on how they can navigate that HE space. So I'll leave it there. Any advice there on all your experience and working with all those leaders, knowing how those leaders speak, knowing what those leaders are trying to achieve, what advice do you therefore have for students?
Yeah, I think this is a great thing to talk about. And actually, I was discussing this with one of my colleagues who works elsewhere. What are the sorts of things we can talk to people that want to make a change, like students, and they might not know how? And unfortunately, universities, a lot of them care about their reputation. A lot of them care about money. And if you can kind of tie in your points related to those two topics, I think they're more likely to hear you. So for example, if a student sees on the internet that a university has done like a really great initiative and they think, oh, this would be so cool to happen at my own university. And then if they can have a chat with someone, whether it's at their student union or someone at the university they feel comfortable talking with, being able to say, oh yeah, this university has had like a lot of attention, positive attention, because they've done this initiative. There's been a lot of positive feedback from its own community and like the wider society. This is something we should think about. And then that can like make people at that university think, oh wow, actually maybe we should think about maybe people talk about us doing it. And then also with EDI, with the money point, people will go to a university if they feel it aligns with their values or it's a very inclusive space. And if we're looking at Gen Z, and as well as Gen A, which is coming up now, Gen A cares a lot about values and they want to like spend money with organizations, companies that align with their values very strongly, even more so than Gen Z. So I think that is something that universities need to think about. That's coming around the corner. And so students, you should be aware that you have that power, and with where you can give your money to in terms of universities, because I think there will be a trend in the next few years when you see universities who are doing really well with EDI and are doing great with numbers, whether it's UK home student numbers, international student numbers. And then if there's universities that have been known to be bad with racism, EDI, less, they'll have some people, like I think universities are always going to get students, but it'll be maybe a different quality of students, or maybe it'll be not as many students as they would like to, and they wouldn't get so many like positive things about them written in like press and social media. So yeah, students, you definitely have that sort of power, and universities really need money right now. Like, they're always worried about their finances. So yeah, you have that power.
You know what, that point you made about that sort of purchasing power of students, nail on the head, because one thing I've always said is that I believe the sector is lucky. And one thing we haven't mentioned in this episode is a phrase or terminology, award gap. That is what I work on most days. I'm sure you get consultancy requests off the back of, I imagine, terrible award gaps. And that is the difference in achievement between two groups. And I know that's a poor turn of phrase. It's not the difference in achievement between two groups. It's the difference in award that universities give to two groups. And actually, I'll link a blog that I've written in the description below on the award gap and why it's shifted from being called the attainment gap to the award gap, because even I slipped up there in terms of language, and it has a major impact. So anyway, what I want to say is universities have been lucky, because if students actually paid attention to the award gaps that are going on across the sector and it had a bearing on their decision, some universities would be out of business. Because why would you go to a place where you are, hypothetically speaking, I'm thinking of no institution, right? If you are, I don't know, 50% less likely to achieve a good degree than your white counterparts, it doesn't make any logical sense. But because that isn't part of the league tables, it isn't part of the decision-making process, and it's very niche knowledge, then it doesn't have a major bearing on decisions thus far. But if that shifted, the sector would shift.
Yeah, it should shift, you know. Like, honestly, that's an idea to lobby the league table groups. Why don't you include something along those metrics?
Well, one of the things it would definitely be great. And one of the things I've been trying to think about recently, and you know this because we've spoken offline about what I'm trying to do at my workplace. You know, the area that concerns the award gap is called access and participation within higher education, right? And initially, or first of all, there is a regulatory requirement to do this work. Universities are monitored and regulated by the OFS, and they have to do this work in order to maintain that registration and be able to charge £9,250 per year to home students. That regulatory bit only concerns, really, if we're being honest, the leaders and the board. There's a very niche, small audience for that. Another part of this work is the moral side of things. The moral side of it is doing that work and closing that award gap because it matters, because it's important, because it impacts people's actual life outcomes, and because universities are supposed to be progressive organisations that want to make the society a better place to live in. Equal opportunities, etc. So there's a moral argument. But the moral argument only goes so far in terms of impacting those change makers, because like you say, money is the bottom line here. And if students aren't making their decisions on the basis of the award gap, money isn't being affected. So one of the discussions we've had, and we haven't actually resolved it yet, is around how to make that award gap, how to make this access and participation work strategically undeniable, so that it matters to the leaders, it matters to those who have the moral imperative, but crucially, it gets done. So if anyone's got any ideas on that, please do drop a comment in the comment section below. We'd love to hear from you. But that's basically just to tie it all together in terms of why it matters and why it matters to students. So thank you for giving those students that advice, and apologies for getting on my soapbox about access and participation, but I felt it was relevant.
No, so, very relevant.
One of the final things I wanted to touch on is, you know, there is the perception that consultants sort of, again, I'm asking you to defend the profession, apologies, I probably should have briefed you on that, but, you know, there is the perception that consultants come in, they provide the advice, and they leave. The actual implementation happens after you leave. So, first of all, is that a perception you agree with? And that's fair. And second of all, whatever you answer the first part of the question, what will you be most proud of the work you've done so far?
Okay. So yeah, that first part, I think that can be a fair perception, because a lot of the projects that consultants get brought in for, they're told to do a thing like a review, they give the report and then they go. But actually, one of the things that I quite like, so I do my own freelance consulting work, and then I also do work with Halpin consultancy. And one of the things that Halpin does, they say, we will come back to you in 6 to 12 months to see how implementation is going, free of charge, and to see what could be done to help. And so I quite like that they built that into their own package. And that's something that when I do work with other organizations, student unions, I want to be able to like check in with people. And I have had like check-in calls with people just to see how progress is done. But I don't think that is widespread across the consultancy profession. People aren't obliged to do it. As I said, it was a free of charge thing, but I think it's a nice thing to do. But then also another thing that I do think a lot of consultants will say is that, okay, we come in, do this review, give you this report. But if you do need any help with implementation, reach out to us. And that's like a paid service. So I think a lot of consultants, they want to have like follow-up work. So if they know that there are like recommendations in there that they may need some help with, they may say, you know, don't forget to like tap us up. Yeah. So, but yeah, I think it's a fair perception, to be fair.
So with that in mind, what would you be most proud of up until right now?
The project that I'm most proud of?
Yeah.
I think it definitely has to be Living Black. I've done two research. Thank you. I've done two research projects related to Black students that have been published. So Living Black at University and the 2020 report that I mentioned that looked at the responses of universities to Black Lives Matter. So those are the two that I'm most proud of. Living Black, I'm probably the most proud of because of like its widespread impact. People are still talking about it. It's inspired like spin-off projects in different institutions. And it's just really nice to see your own research being like living and breathing and not like gathering dust on a shelf. And then also with the first report that I did in 2020, that was my first like ever piece of work that was published as a consultant. And you get a bit nervous, like, oh, is this actually going to be used? Are people going to like it? And even when I went to Edinburgh, that conference I mentioned a bit earlier, I was talking about anti-racism. Someone came up to me and said, "Oh, I read your 2020 report, and we still use it to help like guide our processes
Wow.
in our university." And like that was a surprise to me because that project didn't have like the budget and like marketing power that Living Black did. And for someone to come up to me and say, you know, the first report that I did, she doesn't know it was the first report I did, had that sort of influence and still does. That was really like great. So yeah, those two things.
Amazing, amazing, and what an impact as well. And just to circle back to right at the start, you were talking about positive people in your life who told you and sort of gave you that confidence and empowerment to say, yeah, you can do this and you can do it well. And hey, they're right, they were right. Talking of those positive people right at the start of your journey, sisterhood is a theme for Black History Month for this year. It's 2023, it's October. Could you possibly just think of one or a couple of people with the theme of sisterhood in mind, who have supported your journey? Shout them out. Here's the platform.
Yes. So the first name that came to my head is my mom. So I just want to like shout her because she came over to this country in her 20s from Nigeria, and everything that I have now, like she and my dad, they built up from scratch basically, didn't have anyone helping them. She was in a full-time job in the mental health profession. And like now she has her own business and a very successful business. So I think being able to see my mum just like graft really hard. We came from a council estate. Now we live in like a four bed, is it a four bed or
Jeez.
five bed house? Like it's just great. So she's definitely an influence that yeah, I love. Other Black women that I've seen that have inspired me in the student union space, I think Shakira Martin's probably the first like Black woman, Black leader that I saw that inspired me. She was NUS president a few years back, so yeah, I thought she was great. Another woman that inspires me, she's called Hillary. She is a consultant. She's changed job recently. So she works at JISC, but she was a what's it called? A consultant at Advance HE, or she still is. And she was NUS president at not as NUS president, and NUS vice president a few years ago, and she's from Ghanaian heritage. And again, it was great to see like a Black woman in the space doing what she does. So yeah, big up to her. I follow like a lot of Black women on my LinkedIn, and it's just nice to see like even what I mentioned with the Black History 365. I didn't remember who it was that I saw, but like that's great work, isn't it? So
Listen, the sector is in a great space from that lens of who's working in it, who's really pushing change, who's driving it. And I just think if I could do one call to action for the space, it's just listen to the colleagues you've got who are often working in this space free of charge, free of charge. Listen to those, empower those. And in my experience, the majority of the people working in this space are Black women. So listen, empower. And there's a phrase that I will call her name, Dr. Marcella Day, the co-chair of the GEM Staff Network at the University of Northampton. She is also on, I can't remember the episode number, but it's something like episode 24 of Before Our Friends Die. Make sure you go check it out. She's a travel and tourism expert, and the episode touches on why the domestic tourism market in the UK is only 0.1% ethnic minority. Very, very interesting episode. I recommend you check it out. But the point I'm trying to make is she talks about reward and recognition for this work. There is a dearth of reward and recognition for this work in the sector. And if the sector ups its game in terms of that, we can really make waves soon. So yeah, thank you for that nod to sisterhood there. I really appreciate it. And I learned, I think, three new names there in terms of who I can go out and who the listeners can go out and check out after this episode. So thank you very much for that. Finally, the next generation. We've been talking a lot about that inertia for change, that need for change nonetheless, and the next generation who are going to make that change. So I'm sure you've inspired not just one, but many future consultants on this episode. What advice do you have for those future consultants, particularly those from a GEM background? GEM meaning global ethnic majority, by the way. What advice do you have? You talked about positive people and making sure you're surrounded by those who can tell you what you're good at and point you in the right direction. What advice would you give to aspiring consultants? That's quite interesting. Spotify, wait there. Edinburgh, wait there. What's that other place? Winchester. I want a piece of that. What do they do? How do they start?
Yeah. One of the things that I would say to them is that their lived experience is so, so valuable. There have been times when I thought to myself, I can't believe people are like paying me money to say something that I think is basic.
Yeah.
That comes naturally. But that's because it's my own lived experience. So I want people listening to know that your lived experience holds so much value, and that is like generally enough to get started, and you can work to get more experience in that field. And then another thing is that like you said, a lot of people are doing this work for free anyway. Like the person said to me, people are doing the work that you've done for us in Hull, people would pay you good money to do it elsewhere. I had no clue that that was a thing. And so there are people listening that may be doing some brilliant projects right now this month related to Black History Month and beyond Black History Month, supporting Black students, Black staff. And just know that there are other universities that don't have anyone doing that sort of work, and they can pay you to do that sort of work for them. So there is definitely a market there. You probably already have the experience you need to get started. So lived experience, you've already got that. And then another thing I'd say, follow people that you find interesting, you find their work interesting, and like reach out to them if you want to understand a bit more about what it's like to be a consultant. I'm more than happy for someone to like message me and ask me about it. I've had like calls with some people. There are some like Black women that I've spoken to recently about this field. They've been unhappy in like their own full-time jobs, and they're thinking about what could be, can consultancy be like a possibility? So reach out to people. We just need more of us in this space.
Do you know what? You've nudged me there for a further question, because I can certainly vouch for Osaro's openness in terms of, I reached out to you and you was very, very accommodating. And, you know, even up until, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, we're having calls and you're offering me advice. And this is a year down the line. I even actually referenced you in a job interview I had recently in terms of, can you give us an example of when you've, what was it? You've demonstrated networking skills and what it resulted in. And I reached out to Osaro and we've worked on a few projects together and so on and so forth. So this episode, I think, was actually part of, we produced a podcast episode and all sorts of stuff. So, hey, presto, if you're watching and you interviewed me that day, this is the proof of it. Anyway, I should move on. But the point I'm trying to make is, do you think networking's a natural skill of yours? Because I've noticed a theme throughout this episode has been people, your network. And I'm pretty sure you've told me offline, I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure you've told me offline, networking's not like a natural skill, but it seems to be. Yeah. So explain.
Yeah, I definitely didn't think networking was a natural skill of mine. I feel like I do like hanging out with people, getting to know people. I never really thought about it as networking. I think what pushed me towards like reaching out to people that I didn't know before and like properly networking was when I was president of my student union, and I was always the youngest person in the room, and I would get invited to lots of functions, and there'd be people that would be drawn towards me because they're like intrigued, like, who is this person in this room who's like 30 years younger than all of us?
Yeah.
And when I was in those spaces and I saw how successful people were, I learned that a lot of these people are where they are because of who they knew. You can work as hard as you want and you can get to places, but honestly, like, so many people get stuff because of who they know, whether it's a job or a recommendation somewhere. It's who you know. And I think my role as president like really instilled that in me, so I'm more conscious of that. So even though networking isn't something that is supernatural to me, I'm trying. And one thing that I may do, and other people may, it might be an advice for someone, but like, for example, LinkedIn, if you talk to someone in a conference, it's nice to like reach out to them, and don't just like add people on LinkedIn if you don't like know them very well. But in what I would do is send like a personalized message. So I recently connected with someone that I don't actually know, but she's linked to the British Youth Council charity, and I sent her like a personalized message because she must get lots of requests, and it's annoying getting requests for someone you don't know. But yeah, I think it's a nice touch. So yeah, think about like tailoring what you say to people. And I think people feel like you're paying them respect if you're taking time to like write a little nice message, like, oh, this is why I want to connect with you.
Defo. And you know, if you want to make sure you get your LinkedIn to where it needs to be before you make those little reach out moments, check out episode 30 and 32 of Before Our, sorry, 31 and 32 of Before Our Friends Die featuring Danny Mirza, where we give you top 10 LinkedIn tips to make sure your LinkedIn is the top it can be. So there we have it. That has been Before Our Friends Die on the Hacking Selfish Digital Network. You've been joined by me, Kavan, and this is the episode with Asara Otobo, where we got stuck into consultancy, EDI, and much, much more. Make sure you share it with a friend, give it a 5-star rating and review, like, comment, subscribe, all those great things, because it helps us grow. I really appreciate it. And finally, if you want to hear more from us, make sure you check out our other shows too. We've got Sofa Senseis if you're into combat sports, and we've got Cool, Fight, Done, Wicked. If you, like Asaro, love Spotify and all things music, that's the show for you. Finally, if you've got any questions or comments for us, please do email akiandsaltfish@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. I will personally reply if you get in touch. So, before I get to the end, Asaro, where can the people find you?
LinkedIn. So, yeah, find me by typing out my name, Asaro Otobo. LinkedIn, Twitter. Well, it's called X now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Asaro Hazel. So Hazel's my middle name, but Asaro Hazel's my handle. If you type in Asaro Otobo, my name should come up anyway as well, because that's in my like display name. So those are the two main places, LinkedIn and X.
Brilliant.
Formerly known as Twitter.
There you go. Make sure you follow Asaro and connect with her. And don't forget to leave a personalized message too, if you've been listening. Finally, next week, part 2, 7 signature questions, where we get to know Asaro. Don't miss it. Take care. See you next time.